For those of you in the room who are married or who have been married, I want you to take a moment and remember your wedding day, the bliss and the anticipation that you felt. You knew that you were going to walk down the aisle or watch your spouse walk down the aisle, and you were going to be put together in front of God forever. And there's this excitement, there's this tangible, like, this is the best person in the entire world that God gave to me, and I get to be with that person forever. I remember there's just like this joy that just makes you want to jump out of your skin. Okay, now not to be the Debbie Downer, but how long did it take before you had your first good fight? Did you make it to the end of the day or the end of the week or the end of the month? Michelle and I made it a couple weeks in onto our honeymoon. Yes, I delayed our honeymoon 3 weeks for work. By God's grace, that wasn't the fight. It was while we were on our honeymoon that we had the fight. And it's so strange because it's like, this is the person I love more than anybody else. And even that person, you make those vows, you're going to be with them forever in sicker or sickness and health, for richer or poorer. You guys know what I'm talking about. And in your mind, you're like, this is the one person I will never, ever fight with. It's going to be perfect. But it doesn't take you very long before you realize even that person, you're still going to have conflicts with. And the reason is because you are a sin-filled human being with your own experiences and desires and perspectives, and you're marrying somebody who is other than you, who also has a sinful nature with their experiences, preferences, and desires. And at certain points, you are going to see things differently. Conflict stinks. Nobody enjoys it. Nobody's like, oh, my spouse is mad at me today. This is a good day. Like, there's a weight when you know that you're in an argument with somebody or things just aren't right and there's a rub in the relationship and everybody feels it. Nobody enjoys it. Nobody wants it. And yet, we have to understand, in this life, as imperfect as it is, conflict is going to be unavoidable. Nobody will ever get through life conflict-free. No relationship will go forever without any arguments, any disagreements, or any conflict. You can't avoid it. You can only learn to navigate your way through it by God's grace. You have to understand, strong marriages, good friendships, and close families are not all without conflict. They are just filled with people who have learned how to walk through the conflict in healthier and God-honoring ways. And so this new series that we're kicking off called Conflicted, or as I like to say, Conflict Ed, like conflict education, you get it? Where we're going to be learning how we can move through conflict in healthier ways. And actually getting to the end with a resolve and healing those relationships rather than just allowing cracks to continually form without ever restoring the cracks. So most people all respond to conflict using the same three patterns that we've all been taught, maybe by our families or by friends, but somewhere we pick up one of these three patterns as our go-to when we face conflict. And you've heard these before, the first being fight. Some people just, when something happens, they respond aggressively. They're like, oh, really? You want that? And they're going to step into it, and they're going to let you know that they strongly disagree and that I'm not wrong, you're wrong. And often, these types of people, they start fires in a lot of places. What they sometimes do, it works, though, because other people become so afraid of that person's temper flaring up that they just learn to tiptoe around the person who always jumps to fight. Maybe you have somebody like that in your extended family, and you're like, oh yeah, everybody just kind of is careful because we don't want to set off grandma. You don't want to see grandma when she gets angry. Right? But we understand, like, we've seen it. Those people who go to fight, they get angry. It leads to a lot of hurt. On the flip side, some people are like, I'm not like that. I just get passive aggressive. Well, that's the same thing, right? That's still going to this fight mentality. It's just trying to do it in a polite way by just following the rules so perfectly that you know you're creating an issue. And you're like, well, actually, I'm just following the rules. I'm doing what you said. Okay, that is being confrontational in a different way. If you are a person who continually goes to this fight mode, what you'll find is that some people don't feel safe in coming to you and telling you truthful things. And you'll also probably find a trail of hurt that you've left behind you. The next way that many people, a common response they have to conflict is flight. Flight is when you just leave the conflict. You're like, you know what? I don't know how to deal with this, so I'm just going to run from it. People who have flight as their common pattern, they run from friendships, so friendships don't last very long. They run from marriages even, so they might have a string of divorces. They run from their own family. Maybe when they're talking about their family, you'll hear that, well, I don't really talk to my sister anymore. My mom and I don't get along very well. I don't have, you know, much relationship with my kids, and it's because this person's constantly running every time the relationship gets difficult. So rather than dealing with the conflict, rather than finding healthy ways to fix it, they're just constantly running from it. And what that does is it leaves you feeling very lonely because you don't have many close relationships at the end of the day. You look around, who are your close friends who have been with you for 20, 30, 40 years? You don't have any because every time a conflict arose, you ran from that person. And at the end of the day, you're all by yourself, essentially. The third pattern is to freeze. The people who just, they're not going to fight back, they're not going to run away, but they just kind of put up their defenses, their protective shell. Maybe they allow others who are telling them that they're not doing a good job to lower their self-esteem, and they feel like, well, I must be the reason for the conflict. I must be the problem. Often these people learn that the best way to move forward is to just say, fine, I'll just put a wall between you and I. And so when you start yelling at me, yeah, I see your lips are moving, but I'm not really hearing it. And some people do that in many of their relationships. Well, here's the thing. If I build a wall with you, and I build a wall with you, and I build a wall here, and I build a wall there, at the end of the day, I'm the one who's in my own prison, where I've built walls between me and everybody else to protect me from the hurtful things they are saying, rather than learning to deal with that hurt, learning to deal with the difference of opinion, and work through and navigate through those challenges. So let me ask you, if you are using one of those three common responses, how is that working for you? Right? I think all of us can probably recognize, naturally, we all lean into one of those three responses. Like, that's our default if we leave it unchecked. I can be real quick to just run from something. Like, oh, there's conflict there? Okay, I'll move on. I don't need to have this job. I'll just go to the next job. I'll find somebody else. But after you do that a few times, you learn it's never different somewhere else. The people who are in the fight mode, they can, you know, find a new boss, but it's not going to be different. If you fought with that person, you're going to fight with that person. The freeze people are going to just be building walls wherever they go. This issue is, you know, all three of these, the problem is they don't actually resolve the hurt. They don't resolve the offense, whatever it is. Maybe it was an action. Maybe it was an unkind word. Maybe it was a misunderstanding. But if all you do is jump to fight, flight, or freeze, you're not actually dealing with the root of the problem. And so today, we're going to talk about God's grace-filled alternative to those three responses to conflict. And this alternative is challenging, and it comes at a high cost. It's a high price. It's not easy to do. but it actually deals with the root of the conflict. And so God's key to conflict is forgiveness. This is why preachers alliterate and use the same letter for everything, because even God gave us a fourth F today. All right? So we don't fight, flight, or freeze. We learn to forgive. That's what we're going to be talking about. But before we jump straight into forgiveness, I want to give you a few filters to run your thinking through before you always make mountains out of molehills. You see, I think there's a little bit of prevention that we can do to try to keep from living in so much conflict in our lives. So there's two major mistakes that I think many people make to create more conflict around them than they need to. And the first mistake they make is that they misinterpret a situation and they instantly think that that person's mad at me. That person, I can't believe they said that. I can't believe that person thinks that of me. And they look at a situation where maybe there's not total clarity, and they assume the worst in the situation, and they create conflict out of absolutely nothing. So a great example of this comes from Joshua chapter 22. I actually preached a sermon on this one point. It was a full message about 4 years ago. The Israelites have gone into the promised land, and they've fought, and they've cleared everybody out. And what ends up happening is 9 of the tribes of Israel decide to stay in the promised land, but 3 of the tribes liked the land before they got to the promised land on the other side of the Jordan River. And they said, hey, now that we've helped you clear the promised land and you're settling in your cities, can we go back to the land we want? All good. They make a big altar on the side of the 9 tribes right by the Jordan River. Well, the 3 tribes cross the Jordan River to build their cities and build their families, and they make a matching imposing altar on the other side of the Jordan River. The 9 tribes see this altar erected, and immediately they say, they have decided to follow other gods, and they are abandoning us. They jump to the worst. There's no reason for them to jump to that conclusion. But they gather all their warriors together, and they are ready to go to civil war and go kill those that they just fought with. Rather than getting clarity on the situation, they do wisely send some delegates to say, what have you done? And those on the side of the 3 tribes said, we didn't want to be forgotten and have you think that we weren't part of you. So we built a matching temple or altar to show that we worship the same God you worship. There was no malice or negative intent here. There was just a misunderstanding. If they hadn't taken the time to clarify right away, they were potentially going to go to war over absolutely nothing. So this teaches us a pattern that we must learn. Don't assume the worst. Sometimes we do that about people. They say one thing and we hear it funny and we're just like, I can't believe they think that. Don't assume the worst. Give others the benefit of the doubt. And then go seek clarity. Say, hey, I heard this. I was a little confused. What did you mean by that? Often, when they give clarity, you'll go, oh, that's not at all what I thought. And all of my angst that I was feeling as soon as we had that exchange was for nothing. So sometimes the conflict you're experiencing is Satan's way of just playing with your heartstrings. And he's trying to just create conflict like a magician that appears out of nowhere for no reason, because something is said and for some reason it triggers something inside of you and you right away jump to the worst. You think that person's after you. The number one, I think, cause of this is text messaging. Because in a text message, people are doing shorthand, or some people are talking to their phones and the words aren't even coming out the right way. Am I right, Randy? Like, that's, or, yeah. You have to read it audibly, or and then you're like, oh, that's what they're saying. Sometimes people shortcut what they're saying because they don't want to type all the words out. And the person on the receiving end reads this terse message and it's like, well, why'd they send me that? And all of a sudden, there's a miscommunication over absolutely nothing. In those situations, Don't assume the worst. Just, okay, they're asking this question. Ask a clarifying question. Is there a reason you're asking this? Or, you know, is there something I can help you with here? Or maybe pick up the phone and just call and say, hey, can I help you with this? I thought it'd be easier to talk. We all understand just having the communication over the phone is much better because you can hear tone, right? It'll save a lot of conflict if we just do this one prevention step of not misinterpreting situations and jumping to the worst. The second thing that we can do is to stop taking offense at every opportunity. That's another mistake that's made. There are some people that are just easily offended by small things. And honestly, you can choose to be offended by lots of small things, and you can choose to feel like everybody's out to get you. Or you can say, you know what? Maybe they're not trying to hurt me. And it's still hurtful, and I need to forgive them, but I don't need to make this a bigger deal than what it already is. Does that make sense? This is actually wisdom that's given to us in the book of Proverbs. Proverbs 12, verse 16 says, fools show their annoyance at once, but the prudent overlook an insult. The prudent overlook an insult. What you don't know is maybe that person just had a really bad day, and they just have a really short temper, and so yeah, they were snippy with you. It's not because they're mad at you, it's because they had a bad day. Maybe that person comes from a family where what they did or what they said, it would never cross their mind that that would be offensive. That was just normal in their family. And to you, you're like, I can't believe you did that. And it's just a difference of how you were raised. They're not trying to hurt you. And so rather than allowing it to become conflict and feel like, well, we've got to work this out, to just allow a little more grace for people and say, you know what? This is a small thing. It's not a big thing. I don't need to make something of this. I just need to overlook the offense, overlook the insult. That's what the prudent do. And I think there's a lot of wisdom in that psalm. And if you can do these two things of choosing to not misinterpret the situation or find clarity before you get upset and not taking offense at every opportunity, what you'll find is you prevent a lot of the conflict in your own life. You'll have a lot more peace, a lot more joy, a lot healthier relationships by not allowing these small things to become big things. Satan loves to just drop these little bitty things that people hit them, and like they're like little mines in the ground, and you step on it, and kaboom! There's all of a sudden a huge blast in the middle of the relationship, whereas it's something that you could have just easily stepped over and said, you know what, that's a small thing. It's not a big thing. I'll move on, and I'm going to keep loving you anyway. Okay. So side note on this, if you feel like you are frequently at odds with most people in your life, like you just live in conflict. As the young people would say, you're just like drama, drama, drama everywhere you go. Like perhaps you should look in the mirror and recognize that part of this conflict is that you are quickly escalating small conflicts. Because there shouldn't be that much constant big conflict in any person's life. But if you feel that way with most of the relationships in your life, perhaps the best thing you can do is step back, take a breath, say, God, help me to not take offense at these things. Help me to find clarity and to find a little more peace in these relationships. And the first place you can start is in your own life, in just showing more grace for other people. So now that we've talked about how to reduce the number of big arguments and relational drama in your life, let's talk about what it means to actually forgive somebody and how to forgive when you can't quickly let it go. As kids, you were probably taught when you screwed up to go up and say, I'm sorry, right? We were taught that. Maybe you're taught, give them a hug. Little toddlers come up and hug each other. And if that's all it took, life would be great. The problem is that assumes that the person who is at fault actually feels bad and apologizes for it. And if you are waiting for an apology in every situation where somebody has hurt you deeply, then you are going to be waiting for a long time. And you are going to be the one holding on to that bitterness and frustration and resentment. And God doesn't want that for you. And so we can't wait for the I'm sorry and the big hug. We have to learn to offer forgiveness, even if that is never coming. But before we continue, we have to ask, what is forgiveness? In the Bible, the word forgiveness is surprisingly often tied to economic situations, to money. It's when a person releases the expectation that a debt will be paid. It's like when I borrow $20 from somebody to buy something because I didn't have my wallet on me, and I keep forgetting to pay them back. And now it's been like weeks, and they've asked a few times, hey, do you have that 20 back to pay me back? And I'm like, oh, I forgot to get money from the ATM. And finally the person says, you know what? Don't worry about it, right? That is forgiving the loan. It's releasing the expectation that I ever remember to give them that $20 back. Maybe you remember when Joe Biden was pushing student loan forgiveness. For some people, they're probably very confused. Student loan forgiveness? How do these things go together? Like, forgiveness means I'm sorry, and student loans is money. The whole concept is if you borrowed money from the federal government for college, the federal government would forgive. They would cancel the expectation that you would pay back the debt. That is what forgiveness means in an economic sense. So relationally, how do we use this? Is we take this concept and we say forgiving a person means that after they do you harm or cause damage to the relationship, you are saying, it's okay, I do not expect you to pay me back in any way. You don't need to do anything to make this right. It's releasing them from the consequences of the wrongdoing. Now, it is not saying it's completely okay, it's completely acceptable what you did, I condone it, it's fine. When people hurt you, there are sometimes consequences to that, and that's okay. But it's you personally releasing them from owing you anything else and saying, you know what, I forgive you. They still answer to God, they still answer to the authorities, but you release the debt that you hold for them. This is an incredibly important behavior for people because what it does is it's how a relationship is healed. When the damage is done, when the cracks begin to form in the relationship, forgiveness is how we heal those cracks and we mend those up. As we say, I am sorry. Or we just, even if the person doesn't say they're sorry, we say, I forgive you. And you don't hold on to it. You don't keep this long record of wrongs. The fastest way to ruin your marriage is to keep a record of wrongs and be able to come to the pastor and be like, you know, let me tell you everything that my husband does wrong in this relationship. If you've got that record, you're in a bad place. Right? Because it's hard to forgive. You need to forgive quickly and move on as different things offend you and hurt you. So in studying this passage, I will say all across the Bible, it is very clear as followers of Jesus, we are called to forgive. It is all over the pages of Scripture. These are just three quick verses, but there were many more. In Mark chapter 11, verse 25, Jesus says, and whenever you stand praying, forgive. In Luke 17, verse 3, Jesus says, if your brother sins, rebuke him, and if he repents, forgive him. Ephesians 4, 32, Paul is writing to the church. He says, be kind to one another, tenderhearted, forgiving one another. It is written over and over and over. We are called to be people to who forgive. Here's the problem. The Bible doesn't give us any explicit direction on how to forgive. I don't have like a quick passage that I can show you and be like, here it is, three easy steps. Let's follow that and go. The Bible just says you must forgive. And unfortunately, a lot of people have been hurt so deeply and so repeatedly that they don't know how to actually forgive the person who has offended them. Sure, they might say, yes, I've forgiven that person, but deep inside their heart, they haven't been able to let it go. They haven't been able to actually forgive. And so instead, that offense and that hurt and that pain that's been caused is continuing to fester inside of their heart. And I understand some of you might have been hurt in ways that you will never forget. But that doesn't mean that you can't forgive. Here's what I've learned. It's on the screens. Hurt makes forgiveness hard, but pride makes it impossible. Hurt makes forgiveness hard. The deeper that you've been hurt or the closer the person is who has hurt you, it makes forgiveness very, very challenging. But pride makes it impossible. And some of you might be right now thinking, Ryan, what does pride have to do with anything? Follow me for a second. Perhaps you have at some point felt that withholding forgiveness is your way of bringing justice to the situation. You kind of have this feeling of wanting revenge. And you know that they're getting away with that bad behavior. And the one thing you can do is to not forgive them. And so in some way, you feel like choosing not to forgive them is your way of holding them accountable for what they've done. But in doing that, you are making yourself the judge. You are deciding vengeance is mine, says Ryan. But that's not what the Bible tells us. In Romans 12, verse 19, Paul says, don't take revenge, my dear friends, but leave room for God's wrath. For it is written, it is mine to avenge, I will repay. I think the King James says, vengeance is mine, thus saith the Lord. I have that phrase in my mind. I don't know why. But we sit and we hold on and we want to be the one who says, no, I'm not letting you go off the hook for that. I'm not forgiving you for that. And so you're allowing your desire for vengeance to put you in a position of superiority, in a prideful position, holding on to that. And what God is saying, honestly, you're terrible at holding people accountable. Trust God to be the ultimate judge. His judgment and his consequences on the last day, if that person never repents for their sin, will be much more harsh and more fitting to the crime than your choosing not to forgive them will ever impact them. Right? When you choose not to forgive, all it's doing is hurting you. It's leaving you locked in a prison. It's leaving you full of bitterness and resentment. Let God be the one who's going to hold every person who hurts you accountable. And if they turn to him for forgiveness, fantastic. You have a new brother or sister in the faith. And if they don't, then God says, I will avenge. And leave it to the God of heaven and earth. Secondly, I think the way some people take a prideful position, and it may be holding you back, is because you feel morally superior because you would never do to them what they did to you. You feel like they are much worse, much more guilty, and much more deserving of your scorn. They are a much worse person than you are. And you have this feeling in pride, like, they are bad, I am good, how can I forgive them for how terrible that is? But what you're doing is, again, you're puffing yourself up with pride and you're not recognizing your own faults, your own failures. And instead, all you can see are the faults and the failures of the people who have offended you and who have hurt you. If this is feels like I'm hitting a little too close to home for you, I want to read to you a rather lengthy parable that Jesus told, but I think this is the key for how we can move forward with forgiving others. So out of Matthew chapter 18, verse 23, Jesus tells this story. He says, therefore, the kingdom of heaven is like a king who wanted to settle accounts with his servants. As he began the settlement, a man who owed him 10,000 bags of gold was brought to him. Since he was not able to pay, the master ordered that he and his wife and his children and all that he had be sold to repay the debt. At this, the servant fell on his knees before him. "Be patient with me," he begged, "and I will pay back everything." The servant's master took pity on him and canceled the debt and let him go. That's the economic picture of forgiveness. 10,000 bags of gold is what was owed. And he said, "I cancel it. You no longer owe me anything." That is extravagant forgiveness. Let's keep going. "But when that servant went out, he found one of his fellow servants who owed him 100 silver coins." Let's call that 100 quarters, 25 bucks. He grabbed him and began to choke him. "Pay back what you owe me," he demanded. His fellow servant fell on his knees and begged, "Be patient with me and I will pay it back." But he refused. Instead, he went off and had that man thrown into prison until he could pay the debt. When the other servants saw what had happened, they were outraged and went and told their master everything that had happened. Then the master called the servant back in. "You wicked servant," he said, "I canceled all that debt of yours because you begged me to. Shouldn't you have had mercy on your fellow servant just as I had on you?" In anger, his master handed him over to the jailers to be tortured until he should pay back all that he owed. This is how my heavenly Father will treat each of you unless you forgive your brother or sister from your heart. Here's the key to being able to forgive those who feel unforgivable. You must recognize your sin is much worse than you think. And God's forgiveness is much more extravagant than you will ever understand. You see, we don't forgive by thinking about how the other person needs forgiveness. We forgive by thinking about how much we need forgiveness. We don't focus on how much grace that other person requires for what they've done. We focus on how much grace God has already shown to us. We think about the fact that we have sinned against an infinite God. We think about how we have rebelled against our Maker and that we have cheated on Christ every single day. And yet God forgives us. He has essentially forgiven each one of us of thousands of bags of gold, and we're worried about 100 silver coins, 25 bucks. That somebody else did something to offend us. We've made that little molehill into a mountain and said, "This is terrible and I won't forgive you." We're able to forgive others when we recognize the grace and the forgiveness that God has shown to us. It puts everything into perspective in our own lives. Understanding God's grace in our lives, we then need to make the choice to forgive. The way you forgive, some of you might be saying, "Ryan, how do I do that? I've tried. I don't know how to do it." Take it to God in prayer, okay? While you're praying, say, "God, this person hurt me." And name how they hurt you. Name the person. Be specific in your prayer and say, "But God, help me to let it go. Help me to release this debt from this person. Help me to stop holding on to this in my heart." At this point, I'm not even saying you have to go to that person and say, "I forgive you." Some people don't even know you're upset with them, and having that conversation can be really awkward and weird. Forgiveness starts with you making things right with God in your own heart and what that person has done to you. So you say, "God, this person did this and it hurt. Help me to release it and help me to let it go." And it may be the type of thing that every time that hurt and that broken piece comes to your mind, you have to continually pray that prayer over and over. But across time, as you consistently do that, God will heal your heart. You'll be able to let that go. you'll be able to forgive and release the debt and not think about how that person owes you for what they did. Look, God tells all of us to forgive, full stop. Scripture is very clear. You must forgive if you want to be forgiven. It's all over the New Testament. Numerous passages, including this parable, tell us this is the truth, and this is how God's economy works. He isn't asking you to do something which he knows is impossible. He knows you can do it. He's asking because he knows that it's what's best for every single one of us. He knows the power that sin has over a person, over you and them, by having this conflict between you two. And the only way to move past that power that sin holds over that relationship is for you to choose to forgive. That's how you defeat the power of sin in that relationship. Because that's what all offense is. It's sin. It's somebody doing something they shouldn't have done. And the way that that power of the sin is released is for you to cancel the debt, to release it, and to say, you know what, I'm not going to hold that against you any longer. God knows that in that relationship and in all the other relationships in your life, you will only be able to move forward and have healthy relationships if you cancel the debts and you learn to be a person who forgives. That you stop using the three F's that the world is using of fight, flight, and freeze. And you go to God's way and you say, I'm going to make forgiveness my number one way that I deal with conflict as I try to restore relationships as much as I can in a safe way. And the reason God knows that you can do this and it's not impossible is because he did it first. God is essentially expecting you to do what he already did for you, and that is to forgive. You can say, but God, you don't know how deeply this person hurt me. He does. Jesus was betrayed. He was abandoned. He was arrested for no fault of his own, mocked, beaten, abused, laughed at, crucified, all in a 24-hour period for nothing he ever did. And it's not just the big things in his life. He lived a human life for 33 years. He dealt with all the stupid things that people said to him that probably hurt his feelings, and he chose to forgive. He dealt with all the opportunities to have miscommunications, and he took the time to think the best of the person and not assume the worst. All the ways that we have opportunity to get angry and allow conflict and resentment to grow in our hearts, he experienced it all. And he chose forgiveness for every person who wronged him, and more than that, for every one of us who has ever wronged our righteous Heavenly Father. And he paid a price higher than we'll ever pay. We're like, but Ryan, it's so hard to forgive that person. Jesus is like, I literally spread my hands on a cross and died for you to have the right to be forgiven, for you to have a relationship restored to your God. The least you can do is release people from their penalty of sin of what they've done to you so that you can have a restored relationship with the people who matter most in your life. The first step, I think, for forgiveness then, if we say forgiveness comes from understanding that God has forgiven us, is that we have to have a right relationship with God. We have to receive his forgiveness of our own sins. Maybe you're in this room today and you've never made a commitment to follow Jesus. You've never received his forgiveness. You've heard this message of forgiveness, but you've never received it for yourself. You're just kind of living life your own way. Today's the day, I hope, that you consider, maybe I have all this conflict in my life because I don't know anything about forgiveness. I've never received it for myself from God, and I've never extended it to anybody else. I'm trying to hold on to all the wrongs people have done. And I'm saying, let it go. Receive God's forgiveness for what you have sinned against him, and then release everybody else who has hurt you from those sins and trust God with it. This morning, we're going to take communion together. And as we take communion, if those who are going to serve communion would please come forward. What we're doing is we are remembering the most costly act of forgiveness, what Jesus did for us on the cross. This is the choice that he made for us to lay down his life. He canceled the debt of the sin that we owed to God. And he made a way that we could be right with our Heavenly Father. And so all he's asking is, he's saying, look, if I can make things right between God and you, can you not make things right between you and one another? He's not asking any more from us. The secret to forgiveness is understanding how God has already forgiven you. When you feel like that person has done something too big, just remember what you have already done to God and that he's forgiven it. Don't feel bad about your sin and sit and go, oh, I'm terrible. Feel amazed at God's extravagant grace. And may that fill your heart so that you're able to offer that grace to others. We as followers of Jesus are called to live differently than the rest of the world. And part of that difference is that we are called to forgive.